The following episode of the Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com. Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin.
Mush mushy!
This week, we're also joined by a special guest, Coffin John from V-Cinema Podcast.
Minasan, konnichiwa. Watashi, V-Cinema no Coffin John to moshimasu ga, dozo yoroshiku onegaishimasu.
This week, we're looking at High and Low, a cinematic gem from Akira Kurosawa, based on one of the 87th Precinct novels by Ed McBain. This is, along with The Bad Sleep Well, one of a pair of noir films that Kurosawa directed in the late 50s, early 60s. The film tells the story of Kingo Gando, played by Toshiro Mifune. He's an executive at a shoe company whose son is kidnapped, or so he initially thinks. When he finds out that it's the son of a servant who's been kidnapped, this calls into question Gando's values. The disparity between wealth and poverty is brought to fore even more in the second half of the film when we learn about the kidnapper, Genjiro Takeuchi, and the world in which he lives. All right, fellas, let's open this up for discussion. I'm going to pass it over to John. Why did you pick this one, John?
Just so everyone knows, the V-Cinema podcast is an Asian film podcast, much like the Projection Booth, sort of. But we have much more of an Asian focus. When Mike asked me, you know, well, what are some films that you want to talk about? You know, I always throw out, you know, about seven or eight films, you know, because I've been a guest on other podcasts. And, you know, it's always a case that I try to throw out some directors that, you know, people know pretty well. You know, I don't want to throw out obscure stuff that you're not able to get. Kurosawa is always one that I always throw out because, you know, everyone likes talking about Kurosawa. You know, personally, of course, I do as well. And the reason why I chose this particular film, I think there were a couple others I may have actually mentioned, but we chose this particular film mainly because I think in the Western world, you know, we think of Kurosawa's films, we basically separate them, I think, into two different sort of categories, you know, one being his period piece, which are basically, you know, the more samurai oriented films, and the more modern pieces, which are, you know, for example, Ikiru, High and Low, Drunken Angel, etc. Which is, I think, is kind of funny because, you know, both of these types of films, they deal with many of the same themes that, you know, Kurosawa sort of enjoys talking about or enjoys presenting to his audience. With High and Low, in particular, I chose this because I wanted to work on I wanted to talk about a modern piece. And I kind of feel that High and Low really is a film that's really downplayed in his filmography. Because on one hand, you can look at it as a genre piece, and it's a very good one at that. It's, you know, it's part noir, part corporate drama, part police procedural, part existentialist drama. And it's all bridged by this excellently shot ransom payment scene on a train. And, you know, my thought is, you know, I think that having read like some past reviews of the film, that a lot of critics of the time basically thought that the film was not up to the Kurosawa standard. And I think it's because, you know, there are certain things like it lacks a central character. You know, the angles, the humanist or existentialist angles that Kurosawa generally presents in his films are much more sublime than usual. The second reason is that I kind of really see the film as an excellent snapshot of post-war Japan. It's a very polemical film in that it raises issues about modern-day crime, or modern-day at the time, crime, as well as its enforcement. And it also shows that Kurosawa was very aware and acknowledged the inequities that were brought upon by modernization, industrialization, the westernization of the post-war Japan, as well as its economy, and the onset of what we would later call in the 80s as the economic bubble of Japan. So that's it.
Just a brief intro. So we should talk about the story a little bit before we really get into this, just to let folks know what this film is about. It's broken up into roughly, for me anyway, two halves. The first half is really, it's like a chamber piece where it's about Gondo, and it almost all takes place inside of his house. And his house is built up on this, I don't know if it's a mountain, but it's definitely, it's a tall hill at least. And he's up there with his wife, and it starts off with this business meeting where it's he and all these other shoe executives. He's worked at the shoe company since, I think he said he was 16, and then he went off to the war for a little bit, came back and kept working at this place and worked his way up. And now he's one of several higher level execs in there. So the first half is this kind of story sets this up, and then this ransom occurs. We find out that it's not his son who's been kidnapped, but his servant's son. Basically, he's had a plot going on in order to put himself in a better position in the company, into a larger stakeholder kind of position. Does all of these kind of things, all these dealings, has put up his house, and he's right on the verge of making this deal when this phone call comes in from the kidnapper. And then he gets kind of thrown into this whole moral dilemma of, it's not his son that was kidnapped. So luckily he's not too much of a dick. He doesn't say like, oh, well, it's not my kid, so what do I care? I'm going to go ahead with my business. He knows that it's the right thing to do, though it pains him to pay off this ransomer. The second half of the film is much more of a pursuit of the ransomer. And really, Mifune kind of drops out quite a bit during the second half, but he's still there enough that you feel his presence throughout the entire second half of the film. So, Justin, I haven't asked you about this. I know that you're a Kurosawa fan as well, but what were your thoughts on this film?
Well, you guys are going to really hate me today, because I have actually a lot of problems with this movie. Not problems in the sense that I'm going to be mean or anything, but, you know, I watched High and Low today for the first time in pretty much easily over a decade. I know that High and Low is supposed to be this really important film. For me, I really don't feel that it is, though. I mean, giving something a Criterion release doesn't mean it's a great movie to me, even though I'm sure most people will disagree. But, you know, I sort of feel High and Low is like Kurosawa at his ego's best. You know, there's a lot of things that just don't sit well with me, you know. And, you know, I couldn't, until I watched it today, I couldn't even remember what it was about. You know, I'd seen it so many years ago. And for me, you know, when I'm watching it, I sort of find myself laughing for all the wrong reasons. I know it's very typical of Mifune or whatever, but, you know, just there's just this very, it's this very intense drama, you know, like slamming your hand on a table and covering your head, you know, because you're in agony. And I find it really funny. And you've got that, you know, that cop that kind of looks like the Asian George Animal Steel, and then, you know, the kidnapped kid. And then, you know, every time his name is said, like, it always sounds to me like they're pronouncing it cheesy. And so I'm like, oh, cheesy isn't worth 30 million yen. So I'm like, when is cheesy going to come back? You know, so, and then, you know, in the first half of the film, you know, the camera technique, it really, for me, it creates this disconnect, you know, in the sense that I find it really hard to get to know these characters. You know, I know the camera is used in a master shot for the most, you know, for the first half of the film, you know, outside looking in. I know that's sort of used to demonstrate like an effect, you know, like the kidnapper is supposed to be looking in on everything. But for me, it really just causes me not to like the characters or care about them or any situation that they're in. And, you know, I get the whole plan, morale and ethics and the juxtaposition of it all, but it's just sort of boring to me. And then, you know, how the whole film shifts in the middle, you know, I have a hard time with that, because for me, I'm like way too deep into the story. So, I mean, it's a cool idea, but again, I think it ties into what I said a minute ago about it being a very ego-driven piece. And I really like my Kurosawa when he's lost in the world of the samurai, you know? The whole second half, it could have been like intercut into the first half for the most part, and it would have worked just fine. The film for me is just a little too long, probably by about 45 minutes, I think. And then, you know, when the shift happens, it's like you're already invested in this story. And by the time the shift comes, it's sort of been resolved on a level. And so I think, you know, something like this was better done in something like Psycho, where it happens at like the 20, 25 minute mark and not done at the, you know, 53, 55, 60 minute mark. What I do like about the film, actually, and on a very minor level, is just stuff like the score. You know, like, I love the little music cues that come in the second half. Like, you get that great reoccurring Bossa Nova, Some Enchanted Evening theme. With a shift, I really love the atmosphere. I think it's really great that the atmosphere shifts, you know, in the middle, and you get this sort of noir film. And so that's really interesting. It, you know, kind of starts out like as this 50s cheap crime caper, and then it shifts into this sort of slow brewing noir. I mean, that's kind of the way I feel about it. You know, I'm not a big fan of the film, but I definitely appreciate it, where it's coming from.
I I think that's a very fair argument against the film, both for and against the film, I should acknowledge. You know, as I mentioned in my intro that, you know, the film does get downplayed a lot, and part of it is because you can look at it as a genre piece. I think, though, you know, also, as I mentioned, the film plays out a lot better for someone like me who has a great interest in Japan at that particular time period. But I think you can also extend a lot of the themes to, of course, you know, now here in the more modern days. You know, there's this acknowledgement of class disparity brought on by things like...
I was going to say Occupy Wall Street, because...
Exactly. I was just going to mention that. Well, not only just...
Definitely the 1%.
Then not even just Occupy Wall Street, but I think also the Tea Party can also be included in this too, because there's this acknowledgement, even the Tea Party, I think, acknowledges that there's this disparity, but they just don't necessarily want to be a part of the lower order, let's say, so to speak. My politics as far as, you know, the Tea Party are concerned are very different. So, you know, I don't know exactly, you know, that's kind of my interpretation of things. But looking back at Japan at this particular time, you know, there was this rapid industrialization, this rapid growth, and, you know, capitalism, you know, especially consumer-based capitalism, you know, was very much driving its way into the country. And I think that's where, you know, if you can get past, you know, the genre part of it, and, you know, it's not really, I don't know if it's really necessary to do that, because you have to see a film for what it is first. But if you look at beyond that and you look at, you know, well, let's look at, for example, something like Yojimbo, which is a period piece, and something like this, and how they differ in their themes and how they approach their themes, I think it's a little easier to appreciate. And again, I'm not necessarily saying that you have to do that. That, you know, look at both sorts of films to, you know, and look at one and to appreciate the other. But I think it sort of helps. And, you know, I really feel that this film is an extension of his prior films, ones like Drunken Angel, you know, and this acknowledgement of the post-war Japan and looking at how the country was affected and how the mindset was at that time.
I love that there are these very dramatic shifts in the tone to the film. It's almost like getting multiple films in one. It's like the the good version of Grindhouse, where I'm getting a few films for the price of one. And I love the first half of it. I love both parts of it, but the first half of it, I kind of like that distance that the camera is keeping, and I love the way that everything is being framed. I mean, obviously Kurosawa is just famous for his framing, and I love the way that all the characters are framed and the way that the camera shifts, the way that the characters shift. I mean, the blocking in that whole thing, the way that characters get closer to the camera, farther from the camera, really showing their power throughout the scenes and stuff. I thought that was wonderful. There's one take in there, I think, that's almost like 10 minutes long, and it doesn't call attention to itself. It's just one of those things where if you're watching it, it might finally click, oh my God, they haven't cut in all this time. And I love those kind of longer takes, and it's very meditative. It's very stagey, and I really like that about the opening of the film, because it just adds so much more dynamism to the second half, where it is that police procedural, and you've got voiceover narration as you've got the cops going out and tracing down their leads and getting together in these meetings and going over all their evidence and stuff. And I really enjoy that. To your point earlier, John, that middle part with the train, there's something very, very exciting about that scene, and just it does culminate all to that point. And I can see, talking about what Justin said earlier, as far as there is that shift, and you might lose people at that point, and maybe it should have happened earlier. But for me, I like that it's 53 minutes of that part, and then almost an hour and a half, I think, of the other part.
Yeah, that was my issue. I was like, wow, I still have an hour and a half to go.
It really fits together for me. And for me, it really, you know, just the title, the whole, what in Japanese is what, heaven and hell, but in you know, English, high and low, and you get the high all through the first part, and then you get the low, and you're getting the crime, and then you get the explanation for the crime. You know, I had read the McBain book, and it's much more the kidnapper story is mixed in with the Gondo story in that one. And so it's very typical American kind of a narrative where you get the what's happening in the house, and then you get the kidnapper outside, and then you go back to what's happening there, and then you get the kidnapper with the kid, and those kind of things. It's very similar kind of structure to like Ransom, the Mel Gibson film, where you've got you're constantly going back and forth between Mel Gibson and Gary Sinise, but you never never see the kidnapper in the first whole half of the film. You just hear his voice. And then the second half is just pretty much his story.
And to Justin's point, or actually to all of our points about how the film doesn't really concentrate on one particular character, you know, again, I think part of that is, like Justin said, it could be partially Kurosawa's ego saying, like, you know, I don't want to concentrate on a hero character or archetype like I've done with all my other films. I want everyone to be equal, you know, which kind of goes along with this high and low theme, possibly. But I think that if you could just sort of tear away your feelings about that, I mean, you can actually see High and Low as almost being like a Kurosawa reunion film in some ways, because you have all these character actors and regular actors who work with Kurosawa through the years, and they're a pretty good even mix of the older school and newer school actors, you know, actors that he had worked with, you know, in the just immediate post-war days, as well as ones that he would work with in the future, you know, people like Tatsuya Nakadai and Mifune, who represents sort of the older school, even though Tatsuya Nakadai would work with him, you know, well into the 80s. He also had actors like Kyoko Kagawa and Isao Kimura and Takashi Shimura and Tsutomu Yamazaki, who a lot of listeners might remember as being the cowboy character in Tampopo. Other actors, you know, such as Minoru Chiaki and Yunosuke Ito, Nobuo Nakamura, you know, all these actors were like this almost like Kurosawa like school, and that this film High and Low was sort of their classroom reunion, you know, and that's why I like about it, you know. And again, that's looking at the film in retrospect and not looking at it at its time, because at its time, you know, I think Japanese might see this film as being almost like an all-star film for its time.
You know, one thing that I forgot to mention earlier that I really appreciated about the film was just the fact that there's these really great scenes where you get these really loud blasts of audio and then everything just drops. And it cuts to almost silence, like it's a silent film. You know, so I really appreciate the technique here. You know, the whole thing of the shoes at the front I've got a problem with, and then, like, the thing kind of drags on, and I decided today that it wasn't really a coup d'etat that was happening, it was a shoe d'etat.
Oh, the shoes were in the source material, right?
Correct. The shoes were in there, yeah. I love the pride that Gondo takes in the shoes, how he tears the one shoe apart, basically, just saying, you know, don't make these cheap shoes. You know, we have to make things that last long. It really does speak to the whole consumer culture thing, where it's like, people do make cheap stuff so that it has to be replaced. Who wants to make things that last a long time, so that you don't want to sell a car that is going to last for 40 years. You want to sell a car that's going to last for 5 years, and then the poor sucker has to come back and get another auto loan and get another car. So
exactly. Or your iPad 1, 2, and 3, you know, just right. Keep making it a little bit better incrementally each year so the consumer comes back again and again.
Exactly. The one thing that I wanted to touch on too is in the low part in the whole film, really, I love the use of reflections, and I love in the high part of the film, I love the sun going down and the use of the miniatures outside, the whole miniature set of the outside darkness, and just how much attention that Kurosawa paid to the setting. And I think they had a set version of his house. They actually shot at the house, and then they would shoot from down below. He would actually do stuff with, like, having cars set up to go across a bridge so that when they're inside of the house shooting down on the city, he was able to control some of the traffic and stuff that was happening right in the city. But talking about the low part of it, the mirrored sunglasses on the kidnapper, absolutely love that. I love that he, even though we're seeing him, he's still a mystery so much of that second half of the film. The obvious metaphor is that he is a reflection of what society is kind of doing, and just he was created by this whole disparity between the 1% and the 99% kind of thing. I like that he keeps those glasses on, and that whole scene at the bar is just wonderful. He stands out so much because he's got those stupid sunglasses on. It really works for me.
Yeah, one thing that's kind of interesting about the set, and as you said, it's very meticulously detailed. As we mentioned before, you know, part of the film is filmed on a set as well as, you know, in real life locations. And even the locations that they couldn't get were pretty well duplicated. Like, for example, there's that one heroin street, which actually I've been to. I lived in Japan for some time, and I've been to this place where that's based off of. And even though it's not, you know, as they don't have as many of those shady characters as in the film, I thought that at least the alleyways and everything looked pretty accurate to what I remembered. A friend of mine who is a big film fan out in Japan, you know, he took me to a lot of locations, just, you know, oh, this is where they shot this, this is where they shot this, that kind of thing. And this was one of the places he took me to, which just happened to be fairly close to where I lived at the time. And I think if I would have visited the place and not known that it was, you know, something that Kurosawa had based on in his film, it looked like something that would be a film set, something that's very interesting. That area has a lot of, for example, foreigners and stuff like that, and was known as being an area that had a lot of drug problems.
Yeah, it was amazing how many black guys there were in that bar. Did they find every single black guy in Japan and put them all in one place?
Like a lot of other films that were made out there, you know, they would go to the local military bases and basically say, you know, hey, you know, come on set, we'll pay you so much money, and then, you know, free food and drinks for everyone, that kind of thing. Mm. So, you know, that really attracted the people.
That would attract me too.
We're going to shift gears for a second here, and let's go ahead and get our top five Kurosawa films out there and why.
This was very difficult, you know, like asking for a top five Kurosawa films, you know, you might as well be asking me like top five of like pizza toppings, because, you know, they're all great, right? I mean, it's just, you just want the whole thing, right? That's kind of the idea. So I was looking at Kurosawa's filmography, and I kept on like staring at it. Hopefully, you know, titles will start popping up at me, and I was just thinking, God, they're all so wonderful, you know. But I did finally choose a top five. Number five, I chose 1961's Yojimbo, strictly for its entertainment value as well as its influence on entertainment media. And I say this because, you know, of course, we all know the its connection with spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood's Fistful of Dollars. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And as well as things like video games, like in Japan, you know, like one of the Yakuza characters, he's a really big guy who has this hammer, right? You see same depiction.
That guy.
Yeah, exactly. It's such an awesome image, and you see that same sort of character in video games every once in a while, like fighting games or, you know, or beat 'em ups, and you know that, you know, that was from Yojimbo, you know. Okay, so number four, to continue, I have Drunken Angel, which is his 1948 film. And like High and Low, I like this film because it's a great snapshot of post-war Japan. And it's, in this case, mainly from the low side of the spectrum. It's about the relationship between a doctor and a Yakuza character. And one thing to note is that this was the first Japanese film to use a Yakuza as a central character. So, you know, that in itself is somewhat historical. So number three, I have 1957's Throne of Blood, which is his interpretation of Macbeth. And I feel this film is on my top five list because it's not only epic, it's also operatic in nature. And I really kind of feel that this is the closest that Kurosawa ever got to a horror film. And, you know, as with all of his other films that are very genre related, you know, they have a very unique approach to them, you know, something that, of course, you know, bears being essential viewing. Let's see, number two, of course, I think this is probably a lot of people's number one, is 1954's Seven Samurai. And to me, this embodies the best of both of Kurosawa's worlds, which I was talking about earlier. Whereas it's a period piece, of course, it's a very epic samurai story, but it's also a very existential drama. That's why I think, you know, that balance between the two is what makes it so special. And I would say really that this is probably his best film, but it's not necessarily my favorite, because actually my favorite is number one here, Ikiru, which is 1952 film. And the reason why I love Ikiru so much, it takes a lot of ideas in High and Low and amps them up to the maximum to produce this really grand sweeping melodrama. Really, I kind of feel Ikiru is the apotheosis of his humanist work. We've talked about films like Drunken Angel and High and Low, these films, and even some of his earlier films like One Wonderful Sunday, for example, that really give this sort of philosophy of Kurosawa's that he presented through his works. And I kind of feel that Ikiru is that philosophy at its utmost and highest level. And I really kind of feel that this film has some of Kurosawa's best staged and shot scenes. So that's my top five. What about your guys's?
I have to agree with you, and I will say that I think The Seven Samurai is his best film, and that is actually my favorite film of his. And then we're kind of on the same page, too, as well, in terms of why we both like that film. I'm going actually the opposite direction, I noticed, but oh well. So, and then number two, you know, I really like Rashomon because just the fact that it's this groundbreaking storytelling, which, you know, so translates across the pond, you know, and how many times it's been used in a film. In fact, I was looking online today and the storyline was compared to One Night at McCool's. You know, it's really stretched out and went far. You know, number three, Yojimbo, because... I'm a huge fan. No, Mike is a huge fan as well of Walter Hill's Last Man Standing. That translates perfectly there for me. And then, you know, John, I have to agree with you too about Throne of Blood because that's number four for me. And that, you know, I'm a sucker for Macbeth and I love Macbeth movies. You know, I do also think that it's really close to a horror film. And, you know, I'm a horror guy, Mike, right? So I love it, you know, on that aspect. And number five, I tell you, this is going to be different because it's not on any of your guys' lists, I have a feeling, but I'm going with Ran because I feel like it's the culmination of something. You know, it's so drawn out, and I just have so much respect for what he put into this film. Like, he worked on this film on and off for like 10 years. It's sort of like, you know, Kubrickian that, you know, he did stuff like taking 10 years to do, like, you know, the storyboards and stuff. So that is, like, masterful, and that's what I love about it so much.
I love Ron as well, and I was very fortunate to see that on the big screen, which was just, I mean, I just fell right into that image that was up there. It was just absolutely gorgeous. At least two Shakespeare stories have been filmed by Kurosawa, and just the source material for so many of his films were Western stories, you know, even with Yojimbo taking it from Dashiell Hammett and all this, but he just puts his own spin onto all this stuff and just kind of is reflecting Western culture back to us through his, you know, Eastern eyes. It's just absolutely wonderful. So number five on my list, also Throne of Blood. So we're 3 for 3 with Throne of Blood. Seven Samurai is number four for me. Absolutely love that film. Though I would say Battle Beyond the Stars is a superior adaptation of that same story. So
that's a great film.
Yeah. Number three, coincidentally enough, the film that we're talking about this week, High and Low, is right there for me. I was torn a little bit because I really like The Bad Sleep Well as well, and I thought about putting that on the list, but High and Low is one that I will go back to more often than Bad Sleep Well. Number two on my list is Yojimbo, also a huge fan of that. One thing that I love a lot about that film is the music. I think that Sato's score is just gorgeous for that. I love it. And then number one, not on anybody's list, but something that I appreciate, the sequel to Yojimbo, Sanjuro. Even though it's a sequel, I think it's actually a little bit better than the original. It's nice revisiting with that character. He gets a little bit more into his past and just kind of is helping out these hapless samurai, and I think it's a wonderful film.
Since we were just talking about big screen Kurosawa, the film that I really would encourage people to go check out on the big screen is Kagemusha. And the reason being is because I think this film really kind of gets a bad rap because it's not one of his best in terms of its themes. It's slightly muddled. Nakadai doesn't have his best performance. He kind of comes off as being sort of like a doddering old man in it. But on the big screen, I think that on screen you can really see its splendor more so than you can on a TV screen. So if you have that chance to see Kagemusha, and it doesn't get pushed around a lot, unfortunately, you know, even on a lot of festivals, they won't necessarily show that one for some reason. Again, I think it's because it has sort of a bad rap. But if you have that chance to see it and you've sort of kind of written it off as being, you know, one of his also ran type of films, then I would say, you know, take that opportunity and rejuvenate your thinking as to, you know, how good the film actually is.
Yeah, any Kurosawa's that you can see on the big screen, he was a master of framing and just everything looks so good on the big screen. I was very fortunate that there's a Japanese society in Ann Arbor. I don't know if they're even still around, but for a whole semester they were doing, every week they would show a different Kurosawa film. It was one of those happenstance that I found out about it, and I was just so fortunate to be able to see that. But I will say that the first time I ever saw a Kurosawa film, I saw it projected in a parking garage, projected onto a wall of a parking garage for the Top of the Park Festival in Ann Arbor. And it was my housemates that are like, let's go see this movie. It's got a goofy name. It's called Yojimbo. And we went and we just all fell in love with it. And ever since since then, anytime there was any kind of Kurosawa that was playing on campus or off or anything, even just a few weeks ago, it's like I'm saying to one of my old housemates, hey, there's Kurosawa's down at the DFT. Sure enough, we went, and you know, we got to see Throne of Blood on the big screen. It's always wonderful to take him in whenever you possibly can.
Even the film that we're talking about now, you know, High and Low on the big screen, on the, you know, on the smaller screen, you know, it's something that you can, you know, enjoy watching, of course, but on the big screen, you really get a sense of all the technical aspects of the film, you know, the blocking, you know, the movement, all the everything, you know, it's just so excellent on the big screen, especially the final scene. You know, when I watched that on the smaller screen, I thought, okay, well, it's over, right? But on the big screen, it just had a lot more emotional impact, you know, with that,
coming down?
Yeah, the screen, yeah, falling down, and yeah. Basically, you know, we have Mifune's character sort of, you know, sort of looking at himself in the, in a reflection. And, you know, that had such emotional impact on the big screen, whereas the small screen, I was like, okay, yeah.
So we are going to take a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes with a little bit more about High and Low.
In a seedy, rundown office in Los Angeles, a pair of businessmen discuss the opposition.
I know these guys better than I know you. Pull a gun, you gotta be ready to kill somebody.
Well, what else we got to do?
Bill Cosby is Hickey. And Robert Culp is Boggs. Hickey and Boggs, a pair of played-out private eyes who'd have to reach up to touch bottom. They're not cool, slick heroes. They're worn, tough men, and that's what makes them so dangerous. When they come up against professionals, they hold their .44 Magnums in both hands and keep shooting until they hit something, anything. Hickey and Boggs. Rated PG. Cosby, Culp, Hickey and Boggs. They'll knock you out of your seat.
You know, we do have a fetish for obscure films. I just found that out this week. Let's compare High and Low to some other kidnapping films. First and foremost, it reminded me, as I said before, of Ron Howard's 1996 film Ransom with Mel Gibson, which itself was a remake of the 1956 Glenn Ford movie of the same name, which was based on an episode of the United States Steel Hour. I love that TV show name, called Fateful Decision. So did you guys get the same vibe at all, or were there other films that it reminded you of? What were your thoughts while you were watching this one, other than of Chef d'Etat?
You know, I was thinking about this today, and you know, there's a lot of kidnapping films that I really admire, but you know, comparing High and Low to another kidnapping film, there's a lot of similarities between High and Low and The Big Lebowski. Think about it in terms of the kidnappers and the kidnappees. You know, you have this juxtaposition with class. You know, you have the, you know, The Big Lebowski, a poor guy, you know, fighting this rich guy, and then, you know, you have the people in High and Low standing around discussing this kidnapping, what to do, and you have Walter and the dude sitting in a bowling alley discussing what to do. Plus, here in High and Low, you mentioned how Gondo is asked to, you know, how to deliver the money in the movie. You know, like they're on the train, you know, throw the money in the briefcase out the window and come alone. And what do you have in The Big Lebowski?
There are a lot of tropes in
it's pretty funny
films.
Yeah.
There's the ransom note, there's the phone call, there's the tracing of the phone call a lot of times, or the recording of the phone call. And then what I was also reminded of while I was watching this one, and I'm reminded of all films that came post. I'm not really familiar with too many films that were pre. I'm sure that there were a lot of noir films that were kidnapping based, but nothing pre High and Low really came to mind while I was watching. It was post stuff. When they're listening to the tape of the kidnapper and stuff, I was like, oh yeah, they do the exact same thing in The Fugitive. They did it better in High and Low to me, but whatever. I still like The Fugitive. But it's funny how crime fighting has come over the years. You know, you compare that where they take the tape around and they play it for different people in all the different, you know, procedures that the cops did. Compare that now to, you know, the weekly crime dramas. You know, like how many kidnappings are there a week on TV? You know, CSI would be taking that tape and be able to pull it apart into like 50 different individual pieces where it's like, oh yeah, and then the make and model of this car that made this one particular noise was this. Mostly I was reminded, actually, while I was watching Ransom, I should say, I was reminded of High and Low, and then I've really not thought about the Mel Gibson Ransom film for a long darn time, which is good, because the less I have to think about that, the better.
I'm just sad that you thought of it in the first place.
Yeah. I should be sad that I went to see it in the
That's
first
right.
place.
That's right. You know, there are, listen, I compiled a list, actually. I was thinking about this, and there are some really great kidnapping films that a lot of people forget about. Right off the top of my head, I'm thinking, for starters, which is probably my favorite kidnapping movie, John Ford's The Searchers. And then, you know, you have Fargo, for example, and I really love Fargo because, unlike any other film I've ever seen, like, I can't watch it all the way through because it makes me cringe to, like, this point that I have to turn it off, you know? Seriously. And then Commando. Think about Commando. The fun, and I know one of John's personal favorites, the Sally Field vehicle, Now Without My Daughter. That's a guilty pleasure for John, he told me over Skype chat.
It's all over his
blog.
Yeah,
that's right. And then you have the sleazy, 70s grindhouse Candy Snatchers, which I love, and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down is really good. And then what I think is the ultimate kidnapping film, which is the 1971 Manipulator film, which is also called B.J. Lang Presents, and it features Mickey Rooney as a drug-crazed taking film director.
And then there's the whole Patty Hearstploitation kind of series,
that's
too.
That's right, yeah. I mean, there's been a ton. You know, you got, like, Funny Games, Last House on the Left, Misery, Blue Velvet, Human Centipede even, you know?
Actually, when you mentioned Commando, I was going to say, like, what's my favorite line from that film is, Samantha, you're so funny. Anyway, but...
That's staying in, I'm just letting you know.
That's fine. When I think of High and Low, as far as like a kidnapping movie, nothing really sort of sparked my memory. But one thing, and I'm glad that this came up in conversation, is the use of technology in the police procedural portion of the film. And actually, that kind of reminded me of Francis Ford Coppola's 1974 film, The Conversation. In a way, I kind of feel that that aspect of the film is sort of handled sort of similarly, because I want to cite the Criterion Collection disc has a commentary by Dr. Stephen Prince, who's a film professor. At one point, he's talking about technology and how it's used in High and Low, and how even though we have all this great technology that we can use to look at other people, that doesn't necessarily mean that that technology can be used to understand them. So that's kind of an interesting sort of dichotomy of how we sort of see technology as something that we can see what people are doing, but personally, on a social level, we still don't really seek to understand them. And I think that's, you know, important theme of both The Conversation and High and Low, to a degree anyway.
No, that's a really good point, because you're right. The cops are just looking for all the pieces that fall around the kidnapper rather than looking for his motivation. And even at the very end of the film, it's still like, why did you do this? And he really doesn't express that good of a reason. I mean, I think that we understand why he did it, because he was looking up at that house on the hill every single day, whether it was scorching hot in the summer or freezing cold in the winter. He doesn't necessarily express that as well as he possibly could. It was kind of funny. I watched the film twice this week. I watched one version with some really horrible subtitles to it, where every maybe fifth word seemed to be translated, and they all showed up about 20 seconds after the people were done speaking.
That was the version I gave you.
That was the version you gave me. And then I watched another version where they seemed to actually translate what the people were saying. That gave me a little bit more insight into this character, but still, I kind of like, though, that it never becomes him really giving his complete motivation, and there is a little bit of mystery at the end there. And just kind of the way that the whole film ends is that mystery. And what you're saying, John, where Gondo is looking at his own reflection and maybe trying to see the answers within himself, going back to that whole reflection theme. John, you were going to talk a little bit about the way that this film actually changed kidnapping laws in Japan.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to be a little bit vague about this. And again, you know, I would really encourage listeners to, if they have the Criterion Collection disc, to listen to Stephen Prince's commentary, because he goes into much greater detail. But at the time, you know, this being post-war Japan again, there was a rash of incidents, some of them which were very high profile, involving kidnapping. And at that particular time, before actually the film was released, there were certain loopholes to the actual description of what kidnapping was. So, for example, in the film, at one point, the kidnapper calls Gondo's house, and he tells him basically, well, since I haven't taken your child, this is not actually considered kidnapping. You know, I'm only going to get, you know, such and such sentence, which was actually true. It was, it's a much lower sentence. At the time, I think if you were convicted convicted of kidnapping, that might be several years in prison. Whereas in this particular case, because of the technicality of the child that he had abducted not being Gondel's own child, that it was not considered kidnapping. It was just something like personal seizure or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, or extortion or something.
Yeah. At that time, there was, again, some cases that were very high profile, some, you know, that had just stuck in the public's mind. And High and Low, at the time that it came out, this is an interesting story that's commonly relayed about the film, is that in that same year, about 7 or 8 months later, there was a very high profile kidnapping in which the child, if I remember correctly, was actually killed. And it was known that the kidnapper had actually seen High and Low. And, you know, part of the fear was that because he had seen the film, he realized that I can get away with this kidnapping and ransom with a fairly light sentence because of this technicality, again, that's explained in the film. But luckily, it's the case that the film is seen again as sort of this polemic, in that the Japanese society took the time to examine the case or the criminal description of kidnapping. And now there are much, much stricter sentences if you are convicted of kidnapping, you know, and partially because of this film. So I think that's sort of another thing that makes the film interesting to me. And especially, I think it'd be interesting for people who believe that film can bring about social change. It's not just entertainment. Of course, you know, primarily it's entertainment, but there's a lot of secondary effects that film can have in society.
That's funny, because in the U.S., if that same thing happened, then they would immediately pull all the prints of High and Low. Right. It would never be shown again. Maybe it would get a VHS release somewhere down the line, that kind of stuff, but it would just be completely vilified, and they would not look at the root causes of the problem or do anything to fix it.
Yep, it's that High and Low video game. You know, Dungeons right. and Dragons, all those evil
natural
things.
Born killers. They're driving roll. Kids to the streets.
I saw Natural Born Killers and I went out and killed a guy.
Well, that's good. If only it was that. Oliver Stone. Too bad.
And then I killed a guy, and then I saw an Indian dancing around me.
I don't know if this is true or not, or if this is just something I heard, but why not just spread some disinformation? One of the things I've heard forever ago was that at a certain point, at least in Japanese culture, it was usually expected that people were not going to get away with the crimes. It was just a matter of when they were going to get caught or how they were going to get caught, not if they were going to get caught. And I was reminded of that a lot while I was watching this. And to go to another Kurosawa film, I was reminded as well as of Stray Dog while we were watching this film, because of the procedural stuff and just the way that Mifune went around the city and was constantly questioning people and looking for his gun and those kind of things. I think there's a lot of similarities between these two Kurosawa films as well.
I think there are far less acquittals than you'd expect, you know, like in, you know, modern society now. We understand that justice has to be served, etc. But I'm not too sure what exact numbers are, but I would say that Japanese police, when they're on a particular case such as this, they are very much, I believe, more thorough than Western police. And the reason why is because there is a large reserve of police force that is dedicated towards more serious crimes such as this. You know, whereas, you know, here in the U.S., I think that the police are basically expected to multitask. If you put on a case and you have to do that, if you have to do, like, you know, whatever regular patrol, you have to do that. But I think in the case of the Japanese police, there are people who are meant to specialize, who will not be out, you know, multitasking or, you know, stretching the budget of the country by, you know, doing something that is beyond what their, you know, their duties are.
If you're a movie cop in the U.S., the thing you always have to look for is the person who's working on another case that is going to tie into your case, because that's always the best way to solve multiple cases all at once. And it usually leads to somebody who's at the top.
What movie is that happening? I've never seen that before.
It's a little vague.
It's just something I thought of.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolicDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolicDB10. That's DiabolicPB10. Visit DiabolicDVD.com today.
This is Mo. He seems to have his life together. He has a job, a scooter, a house in the woods with a crawl space full of dolls' heads and empty beer cans. But Mo, like so many others, is hiding a debilitating affliction. He's literally unable to stop himself from watching really bad movies. Left to his own devices, Mo can consume up to 15 truly horrendous motion pictures in under a day. There is hope, however, and you can help. For just no money at all, you can download an episode of the Drunk on VHS podcast on iTunes or drunkonvhs.blogspot.com. $0 is all it costs to subscribe to all the episodes and possibly, who knows, save a child. We here at the Second Unit Podcast Network are bringing together people like Mo and giving them a forum in which to safely cope with their addiction. Donate by downloading the Drunk on VHS podcast today and support just one of the members of the Second Unit Podcast Network.
Ahoy, mateys. This is KAB, Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340.
Thanks for listening, and special thanks to Coffin John. Be sure to tune in to the V-Cinema podcast and visit their informative site at vcinemashow.com.
John, what are some of the films that you'll be covering over at V-Cinema Show, or what are some of the things that you've got going on that people should be aware of?
Well, since this is the month of horror, you know, right now we're doing horror films, and we just did an episode on Shion Sono's X Day, which we released a couple weeks ago. We've just recorded episode 36, which is going to be covering a Shaw Brothers horror film by the name of Corpse Mania. And by the time people listen to this, then they will have, I'm sure that episode has already been released. After that, there was recently a deal between Netflix and CJ Entertainment, which is the largest investor of films in Korea. So the next episode after that, we're going to do one of the films that got put on Netflix because of this deal. It's named Moss. And then after that, actually in December, I'm going to Japan for the whole month. So we won't be doing any podcasts until the new year. So people stick around to that. And I should mention also that our podcast is available on our site, which is vcinemashow.com, as well as iTunes, Slapdash Radio. And you can also listen to our podcast in app on Stitcher Radio.
So it sounds like we're not going to get to hear any coverage of Meet the Deedles.
Not any time soon. Sorry.
Damn.
That's on the list, John, though.
John, did you have some sort of book thing coming out?
Yes, there's also there's a book that I contributed to called World Film Locations Tokyo. World Film Locations is a book series put out by Intellect Books in the UK, and they basically take, you know, cities around the world, and you know, there are different contributors who will basically talk about films that were shot in those particular cities. So I was fortunate enough to be chosen to contribute to this the Tokyo edition, and I have four essays in it, as well as one large like overview essay, and that book should be available. Actually, it's available now on Kindle ebook if you want to get it off of Amazon in any country, actually, now. And its hard format is going to be available by the end of October. So by the time listeners hear this, it should already be out. So again, it's called World Film Locations Tokyo.
You crack me up, John, because you remind me of that skit on Saturday Night Live where the guy like overpronounces anything that's Spanish, like a lot of newscasters do, or you'll be going along talking, la 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 la. Hey man, what was that city that Godzilla destroyed? Tokyo. Yeah, that's the one thing. Kurosawa should have made a giant monster movie. I really think he would have done a job with that.
Well, you know, Ishiro Honda was one of his assistant directors at one time, so he did all the music
for all those Godzilla films, I think. So he could have done it. Could have done it, man. Would have been great. Put Mifune in the suit. Maybe just a suit. Like, you'd be a giant Mifune kind of going around Tokyo and stuff. Again, check out vcinemashow.com. You can check out the podcast and all these different formats, which surprisingly will sound very similar to what you're going to hear from us. Check out the projection booth at Stitcher, Jackalope Radio, on iTunes. We don't have any Slapdash, unfortunately, so we're not there. Or you can go to projection-booth.com. All right, so let's head on out of here and check out that pink smoke on the horizon.
People of Nicaragua, that is small consolation. This is Robin Fletcher for NBC News, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
What do you think?
Well, it's a nice report, but is this the week to cover Nicaragua?
Well, I think Nicaragua is important. And not just Nicaragua, but also Honduras, and especially El Salvador.
But wasn't the big story the defeat of Ortega and the fall of the Sandinistas?
Excuse me, everybody. I'd like you to meet our new economics correspondent, Antonio Mendoza.
Well, or Antonio Mendoza.
Yeah, it's nice to meet you, Antonio.
I'm sorry, is it Mendoza or Mendoza?
Mendoza, just Mendoza.
Oh, okay.
Well, Antonio... Kathy here was just talking about our coverage of Nicaragua.
Yeah, well, I think that the economic development in that region is going to be a real big story.
Yeah.
Especially now that they don't have to worry about the Contras.
Yeah. Food delivery?
Oh, great. Yeah. Right here. Okay.
Antonio, please feel free. We always order too much food.
No, thank you. Thanks very much.
Okay. All right. Who had the enchiladas?
Oh, yes. It's me.
Okay. We also have a combination bean burrito and chili con carne.
Well, I had a burrito and huevos rancheros.
Oh, there's no huevos. They must have screwed up.
Antonio, you're welcome to have my chili con carne.
No thanks. Say, you guys really like Latino food, huh?
Well, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
hey, guys.
Hey, bro!
You had some enchiladas.
Oh, man. We've got some dynamite chimichangas, too.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great. Can I dig in?
Sure.
Bob, this is our economics correspondent, Antonio Mendoza.
Oh, hi.
Antonio Mendoza.
Well, nice
Antonio,
to meet you.
Antonio. Bob Costas. Nice to see you.
Okay. So, Bob, have you got any hot picks for us this weekend?
Well, I like the Broncos. The Broncos? You're nuts. No way the Broncos beat San Diego in San Diego. You're out of your mind.
Oh, fine. And this is the guy who picked Tampa Bay by 6 over San Francisco.
Okay.
Man, I'm sorry I couldn't find the file on Costa Rica. And also the garage called and they said someone left their lights on. A blue Camaro.
Oh, geez. That's me. Save me some huevos rancheros. Caramba!
You know, I'm sorry. I've just been noticing that you guys really are up on your Spanish pronunciation.
Thank you. Yeah.
But if you don't mind me saying so, sometimes these Spanish words, when you take them and you sort of kind of overpronounce them, and it's kind of annoying.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Well, give us an example.
Okay, what do you call the kind of storm you get with high winds and a big funnel cloud?
A tornado, why?
Never mind. You know, on second thought, I think I will have an enchilada.
A what?
An enchilada, I'll have an enchilada.
I'm sorry?
An enchilada!
Oh, okay.
Antonio Mendoza would like an enchilada! It would be very muy bueno, because Antonio is very hungry. Yeah, it would make him feel really good to have an enchilada!
Hey, this guy's all right.